Welcome to Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm health integrationist Lena Berman with Jeff Fawcett, PhD. We come to you weekly with a critical, independent voice on the politics and practice of health. What's the significance of research findings that show people with autism or even schizophrenia with a fever having their symptoms reduced? It turns out that our brains and our immune system are intricately linked and that this link controls how a developing fetal brain will develop into adulthood. If mom has a cold, flu, or worse while she's pregnant, her child may be changed forever. Add to this the effects of her environment like poverty, hunger, stress, and toxins, and the results are predictable. None of this is really new, but what is new is now the mechanisms are known. We hope this knowledge will make it easier for people to choose how and when to make babies and what to do to build a healthier person. Stay tuned for a discussion of the relationship between our brain and our immune system and how this affects mind and mood. First, an editorial about this week's health news by Jeff Fawcett, PhD.
Thank you, Lena. Researchers at Harvard are working on a way to predict adverse drug effects. You might think that clinical trials should do this since clinical trials are the basis for FDA approval. But that's not how it works. All FDA clinical trials demonstrate is that a drug does what its makers say it will do and won't excessively harm people during a relatively short period of use. This makes it possible to declare the drug safe and effective. In contrast, adverse drug effects are accumulated over time as a drug is used in actual clinical practice. For obvious reasons, adverse drug effects should be avoided. In practice, drug companies have been found to avoid revealing adverse effects even at the clinical trial level, for example, by failing to share the results of trials that show potential harm with the FDA. By the way, drug companies are not required to reveal these negative results. The issue of predicting adverse drug effects brought my attention to another broader issue. The lopsided focus in issues of health and illness on our inside, not on our outside. In my opinion, effective health practices can only come when we work equally with our inside, each person's unique biology, and our outside, each person's unique environment. Why this is so is obvious. Health and illness are biological responses to environmental conditions. It is useful to recall that people have some degree of power over both. Yet in the work on predicting adverse drug effects, we have a contribution to and reminder of the dominance of pharmacology in promoting health and treating illness, methods that are all about fiddling with your biology. This is not unique to drug-besotted medical practice. The pages of the alternative health periodicals I read are filled with the same message. This creates environmental cues that say, dope your biology. But are you healthy because you have a healthy biology, or are you healthy because you live in a healthy environment? The scientifically correct question is not which drug is the safest and most effective, nor is it what of all the possible things to take works best. It is what of all possible things that you and we can do is the safest and most effective. One of the things you and we can do is examine what safest and most effective actually mean. No one that I know of is asking those kinds of questions scientifically. That doesn't mean you and I can't. I hope you're not surprised to learn that civilians like us don't think about and act on questions of health and illness as if they were a scientific project. One group of researchers referred to an adaptive cognitive and emotional toolbox we use to take action, ways of making decisions that come from our biological past, a past in which survival depended on acting quickly on limited information. So we pay attention to environmental cues, we pay attention to what other people are doing, we pay attention to gut feelings, which is our history talking to us. You no doubt have a health practitioner with whom you work, probably an MD. Is your trust in what he or she tells you based on your evaluation of his or her grasp of the relevant scientific literature? Or do you have the sense that he or she is a very nice person in whom you have a lot of confidence? The last is what I consistently hear. Sounds unscientific. Oddly, scientists do somewhat the same thing. A recent study found that a wide range of biomarkers used in diagnosis and treatment have no statistically valid basis. As I'm sure you know, statistics is the bedrock of conventional health science and practice. The explanation for this scientific dissonance isn't the consequence of corruption. It is simply a matter of scientists and practitioners taking actions based on environmental cues, what other people do, and gut feelings. What I did not just say is that the science is irrelevant. On the contrary, it is very relevant. But the science isn't sufficient to fully inform the actions taken by civilians and experts. In particular, the science is not enough to explain why both civilians and practitioners pay so much attention to the biology, the inside of health, and so little to the environment, the outside of health. Consider a common sequence in how someone might become ill. She is exposed to a pathogen. She is infected. She becomes ill. If exposed, is she certain to be infected? No. If infected, is she certain to fall ill? No. Those each depend on the state of her immune system. Sounds biological. But wait. Exposure is environmental, not biological. It's outside, not inside. And the state of her immune system is not a matter of genetic destiny. For example, someone struggling to make ends meet is under stress, which dampens her body's immune response to pathogens. What we have failed to do, individually and institutionally, is devote time and attention consistently to both our biology and our environment in our search for what is safest and most effective. A transcript of this editorial is available at yourownhealthandfitness.org. I'm Jeffrey Fawcett. Take care of yourself.
Dr. Jeffrey Fawcett is an environmental economist. He's a writer and health consultant who produces this show with me and is primary author of our book, Too Much Medicine, Not Enough Health. You can contact him through our website, yourownhealthandfitness.org. Now to our show today, Infectious Behavior, which is the title of our guest's book. And the author of the book is Dr. Paul H. Patterson, a developmental neurobiologist. He's a professor of biological sciences at the California Institute of Technology and a research professor of neurological surgery at the University of Southern California's Keck School of Medicine. He's the co-author of a previous book with Alan Brown of The Origins of Schizophrenia, and today we'll be discussing his book through MIT Press, Infectious Behavior, Brain-Immune Connections in Autism, Schizophrenia, and Depression. How lovely to have you on the show. Welcome.
My pleasure.
Oh, dear. Are you on a speakerphone?
Yes.
We'll need you to pick up your handset, I think.
Okay. How's that?
Oh, that's much better. Thank you.
Okay.
Yeah, you sounded like you were talking to us from a cave. Doing research in a cave?
Right.
Okay. So, I think it's interesting. Your book is very interesting. It took a long time to read. It's not a long book, but it's very dense. And It was interesting. I was thinking to myself about the etiology of mental disorders and how they've changed over the years from blaming bad spirits to blaming mom mm-hmm. to blaming the bugs. Any comments?
Yeah, there's a fascinating history, actually, I think, going back not only decades but centuries. And I think I was really surprised to discover some early experiments around the turn of the last century that people were really interested in the idea that infection was somehow responsible for mental illness. And it started to do experiments, and it was pretty surprising, pretty shocking, the experiments that were done on human beings at that time, some of which led to a Nobel Prize, actually, early in the 1900s. So people have been interested in this idea for a long time, and I think in the last 5 to 10 years, it's become the situation has become much clearer.
Yeah, we've also seen more credibility given to viruses becoming chronic in people, chronic infections like CFS, like chronic fatigue syndrome, or even AIDS, and now people are looking at the possibility that people have long-term infections with Lyme disease, with spirochete.
Yeah.
So You know, this is kind of an obvious question, but I'll ask you anyway. Who's most at risk and why?
For mental illness? Or?
Well, this whole syndrome of, I mean, I can answer it if you want in terms of what I think, but I'd like to hear your opinion. But I think clearly that those who are in poverty, those who are socioeconomically disadvantaged, and people who have suffered severe traumas have much more of a chance of being immunocompromised and being more likely to pick up some of these chronic infections that they'll pass on to their fetus.
Yeah, and people under stress, of course, have diminished immune responses, and pregnant women have a suppressed immune system, particularly vulnerable.
Well, that leads me to my next question, which is, in your book, it's very interesting to read about how much a fetus, what kind of a job a fetus has convincing the maternal immune system to accept it. It confirms my suspicions in my darkest moments that fetuses are, in a way, you know, an invasion in the body anyway. So the body has to be sort of cajoled, the immune system has to be cajoled into accepting it. You wanted to talk about that a bit?
Right, yeah. I call it the battleground of the maternal fetal environment. I think it's clear that the fertilized egg has to actually invade the mother's uterus. It has to penetrate. And it does this by not only secreting enzymes that are responsible for the actual opening of the epithelium, but there's also a suppression of the local immune system there. And, of course, that's necessary because the egg is half from the genetics of the egg is half from the mother, half from the father, and the part from the father, of course, is foreign and would be rejected by the mother's immune system if it were not for some suppression. So there's an invasion, and the invasion has to be controlled, obviously, by the mother, and so there's a kind of a balance that has to be reached. And the more we know about it, the more it seems like a miracle that it ever works right. So many things can go wrong. Interesting sort of side observation that's been made is that women who have a damaged uterus from a C-section or things like that.
Or an IUD that went wrong.
Or an IUD, right. Okay. The implantation of the next egg tends to be right at that same site where there's already been a wound.
There's a little opening.
Yeah. So that's a sort of incidental observation that supports the idea that the blastocyst has to wound the uterus to enter.
So, you know, there's you talk at the beginning of the book about one of the ways that we know that our mood is affected by illness, by bacterial infections and viral infections, is how we feel when all those cytokines and everything else start going crazy in our systems. There is a sort of, one might say, a protective mechanism that the body goes through where it suppresses your mood so that you feel like curling up and being alone and drinking fluids and not going out shopping and infecting other people.
Exactly. It's good. The highly technical term is called sickness behavior. So when you get an infection, peripheral infection, cytokines are produced by the immune cells. These are small proteins that the immune cells use to talk to each other. But these cytokines also activate nerve cells out there in the periphery. That activation is transmitted back inside the brain, where, amazingly enough, inside the brain, more cytokines are produced by the brain itself. And it's those cytokines that are responsible for the sickness behavior that, like you're describing, you get sleepy, you spend more time in bed, you're antisocial, it affects your appetite, and so on. And those are all protective mechanisms. One imagines that, you know, during evolution, it was important for the sick animal to essentially hide from predators in its weakened condition to recover. So it makes sense. And it's driven by the cytokines inside the brain, because cytokines are actually used by nerve cells to communicate with each other, just like in the immune system. So it's a common mechanism, both in the immune system and in the brain.
You're listening to Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm Lena Berman. I'm on the phone today with Dr. Paul H. Patterson. His book is called Infectious Behavior, and it's about the brain-immune connections in autism, schizophrenia, and depression, and probably other little pieces that people will find interesting and that will apply. Ironically, of course, during the winter when everybody's supposed to be resting and people are much more vulnerable to getting sick because of the temperature changes, but it's just a time of darkness when your immune system is somewhat suppressed and people are running around, you know, getting exhausted and undermining those messages, which is maybe one lesson here that we might realize immediately is that if you are pregnant, that behavior we will find is not really good, that what you should do is be very protective of your fetus and try not to get infected. As you just said, the immune system of a pregnant woman is suppressed so that she can accept this new life in her body growing. Is that part of the reason that women get morning sickness?
I think the morning sickness is a response to cytokines. Cytokine imbalance, whether that was actually driven by a need to go into hiding, I'm not sure, but it's an interesting idea. But yeah, it's certainly related to the cytokine balance, mm-hmm. Yes.
And not every woman gets it, so there may be some hormonal changes that are happening there too.
Right.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
And picking up what you mentioned there, prevention. Yeah, I think prevention is really important. It's one of the reasons I wrote the book, actually, to try to highlight that, because it's sort of common sense, but we don't really take it seriously enough. You can take steps. Everyone can take steps that we already know about to try to prevent infection during pregnancy, such as constantly washing one's hands or using disinfectant wipes, getting vaccinated before becoming pregnant.
Yeah, that's not something I would recommend, but wearing, I might not agree.
Well, yeah. I there's a difference between vaccination during pregnancy and before pregnancy.
No, I understand. And your section on vaccination is very interesting. I mean, I think your discussion is very measured. It's very relevant. And we can talk about it at some point when we get to that point. But I think part of what you're saying is that, we've gone from the old days of women being constrained when they're pregnant. Don't touch that. Don't lift that.
Right.
You can't get up. You can't move. You can't exercise. To a point where, you know, my generation of women were out in their Lycra outfits with their tummies and and lifting weights and exercising and all of that. So,
but going to the store and going to the gas station and riding on airplanes.
Yeah, doing the whole thing. But I think what we find from looking at the research and your work here is that there has to be some balance, because when you're growing a baby and these processes are happening, it is possible with a mistake, and it turns out a very small mistake can be a very big issue in terms of damaging the brain of your child and setting up your child for future mood disruptions and even psychosis. Because it's very profound that the combination of the mother's genetic predisposition, her environment, the environment she's in, and then whether or not she actually picks up an infection or whether she's carrying an infection from past generations, like maybe her grandmother even, is going to predispose her fetus to these disruptions. So it means that, yes, now women have more choice. We hope we continue to have those choices. And while pregnant, you can make choices, but you need to make informed choices so that you don't damage the brain of your child.
Right.
Just as you don't smoke and you don't drink, you also may want not to be running around in crowded places where you can catch an infection.
Or wearing a mask, in some cultures.
Yeah. They do that. Yes, they do.
They wear masks, which mm-hmm. seems like a mm-hmm. very good idea.
Yeah. So, you know, one of the things that I got curious about reading this is what the fathers, you know, it's clear that the woman's, for instance, I'll ask you about this in a moment, but if the mother, for instance, has had an autoimmune problem, mm-hmm. or it's in her family line, matriarchally, that she may pass that on, and we do see that people with autoimmune predispositions that may not present. It depends on what their environment is like as a human, but certainly that's going to make her more vulnerable. But the dad's contribution, I'm really curious about that and his inheritance of illness. And let me give you an example of why. I had a client whose grandmother had Sondheim chorea, which is a very interesting, I guess it's bacterial, right? Or is it viral?
I think it's viral.
But it's a very high fever, and it does, in fact, damage the heart valve. Mm-hmm. So the grandmother died probably a little bit early of that, and then her son, who was this client's father, had it as well as a child. And, in fact, he ended up living a good long life, but his heart valve did fail at the end, and that is what killed him, and he might have lived longer. And the siblings in that family do exhibit some signs of having a kind of subclinical, almost Tourette-like, obsessive-like mm-hmm. quality, mm-hmm. which was helped by some of the vitamins you talk about later. Mm-hmm. But the question there is, it is the father's maternal line that was carried on, but I wouldn't have thought that would... So can you talk about the father's contribution in light of that?
Well, in the epidemiology studies of both schizophrenia and autism, it tends to be the mother's immune status that tends to be more important than the father's, but that doesn't mean the father is irrelevant. The contribution by the father is probably relevant but less important.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And maybe that's because one good hypothesis to explain that might be that the mother's response actually during pregnancy to exposure to pathogens is influenced by her immune status, where, of course, the dad isn't around anymore.
Oh, no, he was. Huh?
Just, well, the dad isn't relevant anymore after he...
Oh, after he's inseminated.
Fertilized the egg.
I see. He isn't around inside there.
Right, right.
Maybe yeah. just in other ways, but not...
Yeah.
No, I get it, okay. Yeah, I see what you're saying. And if people are feeling like, oh, well, this is actually complex, yes, it is. And that's one of the reasons I object to the kind of books I get at the first of the year from publishers extolling all of these magic bullets that are supposed to help you lose weight and fix your brain in 10 minutes, mm-hmm. is because the reality of our biology is very complex and very intricate and very mystical and lovely in a certain way and shouldn't be oversimplified, and it's very individual as well.
That's fascinating.
Oh, I love it. I mean, it's the thing that I wasn't spiritual before I started studying physiology. I became spiritual because of the interactions of everything in the body, and I thought, not spiritual in the usual sense, but I sort of got the idea of why people could get spiritual from the science of this stuff, because it is very amazing how everything sort of causes other things to happen. It's just like an old Eastern religion, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So to be clear of what we're talking about, if a mother has autoimmune problems, where she has an autoimmune disease that where her tissues are attacking their own tissues, this might be passed on, or maybe always is passed on, and maybe not in a predictable way.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's because it may not. Does it mean that the child will have autoimmune problems, or does it mean that the child may have a behavior disorder?
Well, it's the epidemiology is fairly clear that if the mother has autoimmune disease or allergies, asthma, and so on, the likelihood or the possibility of autism or schizophrenia in the offspring is increased. And those studies mm-hmm. have been replicated a number of times, and it includes about 9 different autoimmune conditions. So it's pretty extensive area of research. The effect is not tremendous. I mean, it's not by no means absolute. It's simply a statistical increase in the possibility of this mental disorder in the offspring.
And then if you add on to that, that maybe she did have an infection, was exposed to some kind of serious, you know, I mean, the usual ones are the measles and various things, but even a really powerful flu could...
Yeah.
We saw this in the flu pandemics in the past.
Yeah.
There's considerable
epidemiology now on both schizophrenia and autism for the effects of maternal infection of any kind, that is not just the flu, but other viruses like reproductive-associated viruses or bacterial infections like urinary tract or even parasitic infections like infections you might get with...
In the gut, you mean?
From cat litter.
Oh, the toxoplasmosis.
Toxoplasma, yeah.
Yeah, yes. Yeah.
That's another thing to avoid is changing cat litter.
Yes. Yeah, don't... Don't, if you're pregnant, I wrote at the bottom of the thing, you know, if you're having a baby, consider not traveling at that, no, while you're pregnant, at least for that period, not cleaning the cat box,
right.
Somebody else do that,
right.
And avoiding big crowds. And, you know, I will say, I understand why you're saying that a woman might consider being vaccinated against infections like that, you know, getting a flu vaccine. It's just that I found the literature on flu vaccines problematic, and I see people get sick from them, and I also see them not being the right flu. So you're exposing yourself to an infection by getting the shot. So it's a real conundrum to figure out whether to do that or not.
Yeah.
Especially
if you're pregnant.
That's what I'm saying, yeah.
If you're pregnant already.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, for sure.
It's a big question in my mind, and the CDC very strongly recommends getting vaccinated when you're pregnant, but I think it's a difficult question.
That's dicey, yeah.
Yeah.
So, would you say, is it possible to say that autoimmunity presents when the environment is damaging a person's immune system? So, I'm getting into epigenetics here, but isn't it more likely, or is it? I know that autoimmunity also really presents when there's trauma and stress. I mean, if there's a predisposition, the way that you get that to happen is by stressing out a child and frightening it. And then, boom, boy, you've got an autoimmune disease, which is a perfect sort of thing, because in autoimmunity, you have to control your environment. Your body is pushing everything away, you know, indiscriminately, everything. It's attacking everything.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And in the case of during pregnancy, it's very interesting that women who have, for instance, multiple sclerosis, during pregnancy, their symptoms go way down and rebound up as soon as the baby is delivered.
And that's really interesting to me also, because I think that I see or understand there to be an imbalance in women's hormones who are more predisposed to or more vulnerable to autoimmune stuff. So I see them as having an imbalance between their native progesterones and their estrogen, that they tend to be what we might say is estrogen dominant. So I thought it was interesting that people were considering using estrogen as a therapy, and I would think that progesterone would have to be used as well, because I think autoimmune stuff gets worse, and especially multiple sclerosis, in the presence of too much estrogen, and gets quieted by the progesterone balancing it.
Yeah.
All right, well, we're going to take just a brief musical break. This is Lena Berman. I'm on the phone today with Dr. Paul H. Patterson. His book is Infectious Behavior, Brain-Immune Connections in Autism, Schizophrenia, and Depression. If you stand by, we'll be right back after this brief musical break, so hang tight. Thank you. Welcome back. This is Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm Lena Berman. Visit our website, yourownhealthandfitness.org, for easier, extended access to our over 500 archived shows. Choose a download at our new library card feature, or you can download separately. Also, find information about our practice, free stream of this week's show, our book, and lots more at yourownhealthandfitness.org, all spelled out. You can also contact us by email at admin, at yourownhealthandfitness.org. Dr. Patterson, do you have a website or something you'd like to give out?
I have a ongoing blog associated with this book, which considers the recent literature and articles and questions on an ongoing basis. It's called Infectious Behavior, one word, .wordpress.com.
Okay, .wordpress.com. We'll put that on our website. Infectious, Bo, you already got it? Yeah, we've already got it on our website. Okay, so one of the things that I was kind of inching my way toward was the role of epigenetics in all of this, and you do discuss it in your book in a very intelligent way, which is this concept that while genetics may load the gun, it's the environment that pulls the trigger.
Mm-hmm.
So would you like to say something about epigenetics as in regards to this whole issue of the viruses and whatnot, or have we kind of covered that ground?
Well, I think this is a very young and active science, epigenetics, the modification of DNA. And we still are waiting for definitive answers about the role of epigenetics in autism, schizophrenia, and depression. People are really interested in that idea because it's a way of transmitting, and sometimes in a permanent way, changes caused by the environment that are carried on by cells, even if they're dividing, and organisms even after they've reproduced. So it's a way of carrying on changes induced by the environment, and there's evidence that this happens in, for instance, malnutrition. So the famous case is the Dutch hunger winter when the Nazis cut off the food supply in the Netherlands for a period of time, that women who were pregnant during that period of time and were under nutrition status, their offspring were at risk, higher risk for mental illness compared to fetuses that were born before or after this period of time. And the offspring of those offspring, the grandchildren, also were at risk. And people are studying the epigenetic changes in the DNA. And it looks like there's a possibility that these changes might be carried forward. And it's interesting to consider how that is possible. And in the book, I have a drawing of how it might come to be. That is that particularly for a female fetus in the pregnant woman, that female fetus has eggs in its uterus that are potentially susceptible to the same environmental insults as the fetus itself. So particularly for a female fetus that's then born, her eggs could have epigenetic modifications, potentially.
Yeah. Well, and the first, you know, something that just came to mind while I was listening to you is I just this morning received notice about a paper that Dr. Janet Sherman has written with Montegna, I can't remember his last name, but a gentleman, about the effect that the Fukushima radiation dump has had in particularly the Pacific Northwest, where we're seeing a lot of babies dying and stuff. So we can only imagine what the long-term effects are going to be, because the other thing beyond, you know, anything like a virus is just, honest to God, really damaging pollution, and there's really almost nothing worse than nuclear radiation.
Right.
So we're going to see, you know, some very sad stuff. And it does get passed on and on and on and on. The thyroid gets damaged, all sorts of stuff in the offspring for a long time. So, you know, one thing that's interesting about this issue of people whose symptoms resolve with a fever, and you have research that shows that if with autistic kids or even schizophrenics, if they get a good, you know, a good dose of some kind of flu and they have a fever, they suddenly become lucid and able to communicate.
Yeah, this is really fascinating stuff that needs to be further explored, because it has so much potential in the therapeutic realm. And people are looking into it to see if it's really the case, in particularly in autism, as I know of several studies that have started up. But I mentioned that going way back to the turn of the century, there was this idea of the fever therapy, that they actually infected people with malaria who were in insane asylums at the time.
Yeah, really dreadful, kind of scary research with pictures of really scary-looking people giving insane-looking, vulnerable people shots.
Yeah, and the reports were that in many cases that the schizophrenic symptoms resolved during the period of the infection and then returned when the infection was over. And so at the time, it was considered to be a failed experiment and was subsequently forgotten, largely, because it didn't, quote-unquote, cure the mental illness permanently. But it's really interesting that there was this apparently a temporary amelioration of symptoms. And I think this is really something that's got to be followed up with modern methods.
There are clinics in Germany that are doing fever therapy with cancer and other diseases, but primarily with cancer. And they've had some successes. I haven't heard that it's absolutely perfect and works all the time, but I've heard that sometimes it does. And the concept is very interesting, and it makes a certain kind of sense. And it's interesting also because usually the way that, you know, when we're talking about these various sources of inflammation that cause, in the long term, cause damage to the brain and cause, you know, more people being born with these brain abnormalities. I guess you could call them brain abnormalities. I think the people who have them probably don't think of them as that because they're living with them, and the body adjusts to it. But still, it can cause a lot of uncomfortable symptoms in the offspring and make it hard for them to function in the world. So reducing inflammation has been a target kind of therapy for this. But here we have fever, which is a hyperactivation of the immune system. One thing it does point out is that suppressing the immune system when someone is ill, especially in children, in developmental, as they're developing, is not a good idea. You talk a little bit about the hygiene hypothesis, you know, this idea that we're using too many of those disinfectant wipes, actually, and that people need to, particularly as their immune system's being primed as a child, they need to have these childhood illnesses and fevers.
Yeah, that's the hygiene hypothesis, is that kids need to eat dirt, you know, and infants and toddlers, and they need to be exposed in order to educate their immune system so that when they're older they can recognize and fight these allergens and pathogens.
But also, maybe more importantly, need to have fevers.
Yeah, you know, the thing about the fever is if your immune status is already imbalanced, as it is in autism and schizophrenia and depression, then getting a fever is different from a typical person getting a fever. So if you start with an imbalance, say, cytokine situation, fever, you're introducing something that's abnormal to start with, and you're changing it in a way that's very hard to predict. So
to be clear, to give an example, you're saying a cytokine imbalance would be somebody maybe with chronic fatigue, right? So they've got all these extra cytokines making them feel sick all the time. Am I oversimplifying?
Yeah.
Okay. So you're saying having those people have a fever might not be a good idea.
Well, it's to some extent unpredictable what you would expect to get.
Mm-hmm.
So if you have severe depression, your immune system is definitely altered. Your cytokines are definitely altered, and the same with these other mental disorders. And introducing a fever causes a further change, and it might either make it worse or it might restore some sense of balance.
Well, and indeed, what we saw was that their symptoms disappeared for a while.
Yeah, and that mm-hmm. if that turns out to be reproducible, mm-hmm. then I would say it has to do with starting with an imbalanced system and perhaps restoring some balance.
I guess what I'm trying to say is that because we're proponents of do the simplest things first, and of course this mm-hmm. is not simple, this is a very complex situation, and it's a delicate situation, and you don't want to goof. Although in the old days they goofed a lot. They made lots of goofy things, like injecting people with, hey, how about this? What else does it do? I mean, in fact, the beginning of I digress, but the pharmaceutical industry started because they made a fake indigo dye, and then they thought, what else does this stuff do? And they started injecting mental patients, who were usually the targets, and it lobotomized them, sort of. It was like the first horse tranquilizer. So, you know, but anyway, the point is that at the very least, I think what it points to is that there's a complex immunological imbalance going on in people who are at risk, you know, these people who have had either because the mother was exposed to a lot of stress, or she wasn't exposed to stressful things in the environment, or she has a history of damaged DNA from exposures of the grandparents and whatnot. And then she gets exposed to a virus, and then boom, here we have a child with these terrible symptoms. That the immune system is clearly important, and that at this point, took away from this book is that we really don't know what we need to do here, but it's clear that we should be very careful about over suppressing or over intervening, but you'd also don't want someone, as you said, to go have a really high fever and just, you know, that's the end of the brain or something. So it's this, but it looks to me, I'm seeing this kind of balance point, you know, I'm seeing this scale, and it's not at all clear what we can't say anything definitive at this point, but it looks like there's just an unquestionable involvement here, as your whole book states, between the brain development, the brain states, and the immune system. So I don't think we should be rushing to anything. I do find, though, that something that can be done to reset the immune system without drugs is using omega-3 fatty acids, and it also works very well in schizophrenia. There was a psychiatric nurse who ended up getting had her first episode while she was working as a nurse, and did some reading and ended up taking 9,000 milligrams of fish oils with some vitamin E. You have to take vitamin E with it to protect the oil. And that dose stopped her symptoms in their tracks. And if she took less, her symptoms came back. And if she took more, her symptoms came back. So it was this very, you know, and so there's a lot of research, alternative research about using omega-3s. And they are wonderful for autoimmune disorders as well. They quiet the immune system. But you also want to be careful not to overdo that. So.
Yeah, and there actually is a couple of papers on that now mm-hmm. in schizophrenia as well.
Mm-hmm.
So clinical studies.
Yeah, it's fascinating stuff. And then, of course, the work of Abram Hoffer, which was complex and not perfect, but where he used niacin, which you have to be careful with too, because too much of a good thing sometimes. And you mentioned vitamin D, which is another amazing has an amazing effect on psychiatric symptoms. You mentioned acetylcholine.
Mm-hmm.
So and then food allergies and whatnot, which we talk about endlessly on the show. Let me just say that this is Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm Lena Berman. I'm on the phone today with Dr. Paul H. Patterson. His book is Infectious Behavior, Brain Immune Connections, and Autism, Schizophrenia, and Depression. One of the things that's very interesting is that this isn't just extreme psychiatric symptoms. We're also talking about depression.
Yeah.
And So, and you also mentioned that virus, there's a very strong connection between viruses and depression and obesity and behavior effects and depression and viruses and whatnot. And I'm also wondering about whether you've read the research on obesogens, you know, these endocrine disruptors in the environment that can cause people's metabolism to just not function properly. It causes this terrible metabolic disruption.
Yeah, I'm not an expert in that area,
but
heard about it, yeah.
I wonder if you could talk a bit about the blood-brain barrier. I find the research that you discuss in here very interesting, and I'm particularly worried about it because we've discovered that microwave radiation or wireless radar-type radiation, which is proliferating and everyone's using and being exposed to whether they want to or not, causes, there's four pieces of repeated research that shows that the blood-brain barrier breaches when it's exposed to these low-level constant exposures, and that it doesn't, the neurons don't get repaired afterwards. It's just...
Yeah, I mean, the blood-brain barrier basically keeps out larger molecules, like larger proteins, and that's very important because we got a lot of stuff running around in our circulation that we don't want running around in the brain. But some of the proteins that it keeps out are cytokines in mature people. So if you had a peripheral infection and you had a blood-brain barrier that was compromised.
Yeah.
You could get much higher concentrations of cytokines going in.
You're going to get sicker.
Similarly for depressed people, people with major depression have very much altered cytokines in their circulation, and if you had a compromised blood-brain barrier, there would also be contributing to the problem significantly.
So we might, you can't say this, but I can say this. I might suggest then that people consider not using wireless internet. That they wire in their internet through cable and don't buy a modem or router that has little antenna on it. Buy just a wired one, and to not leave your cell phone on all the time and never put it against your head. You know, at best, leave it off when you're not using it. It's just to be prudent.
Yeah, I keep mine off all the time.
Yeah, we're sort of probably going to just stop using it altogether, but we've always just traditionally carried this really old phone. When I say that, people think it's the size of a loaf of bread, but it's it's not that old. It's like 10 years old, but 13 years old.
Wow.
Yeah, it's just an old Motorola, just a phone. But it we traditionally have just carried it turned off in case, you know, you get a flat tire or something on the freeway, but... Mm-hmm. Considering not even doing that because we have, if you do have a flat tire, everybody has a cell phone with them. So,
right.
You know, it's, I don't know. Let's talk some about, we started by talking about fetal stress and maternal stress, but we didn't talk a lot, although it's pretty duh, about this, about sympathetic dominance causing an increased viral infection. You know, predicts that there's going to be more vulnerability to viruses if your nervous system is in a constant state of eek. You know, the sympathetic dominance there makes you more vulnerable. Also,
And that there's
changes
some
the brain
research
too.
On viral infections being much more severe under that situation.
Mm-hmm. That's
experiments
kind of
experiments with. With animals, too.
Yeah, it's kind of obvious, but still. And then you mentioned something that I also know that Bruce McEwen, who has written a lot about to Rockefeller University about stress, that's his specialty, talks about the brain changes. You mentioned the brain changes in the hippocampus. He also talks about the amygdala becoming larger. So the hippocampus is affected, and that can be a problem. And you also mentioned methylation, which is something we've talked a lot about on the show, and it's, as you point out, it's dicey because it turns on and turns off a different gene expression, and there's a relationship between methylation and maternal stress, and there are gender differences. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, and that stress affects methylation. It affects the corticosteroid receptors in the hippocampus, which are very important in response to stress, and if they're turned on too much or for too prolonged a period of time, it leads to it can lead to depression and a disruption of this cycle, that sort of feedback cycle that turns off the stress hormones normally. But if you have a prolonged period of stress, then you don't get that feedback. So in animals research, the methylation and the effects of stress have been well studied in both mice and rats, where, for instance, experiments have been done on young rats that are being cared for by their mother, and if the mother doesn't take care of them properly, doesn't lick and groom them properly, then when they grow up, their corticosteroid receptor is not methylated properly, and mm-hmm. they display a hyper reaction to mm-hmm. to a stressful situation. They overreact to a stressful situation.
And too much cortisol is never good.
It's right.
Very toxic.
Right.
So methylation is dicey because, although in my experience with human people, I do actually give trimethylglycine to my cats. If somebody is over-methylating themselves, usually you know it because you feel pretty good when you first start doing it, and then you start feeling crummy, and if you stop, it feels better. So you can figure it out. But but lots of people are under-methylated. It's not unusual for people to be under-methylated, and it makes it very difficult. You know, they start having high levels of homocysteine. You know, their body doesn't move through the cascade that takes them to glutathione, so their detox mm-hmm. pathways don't work well and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So, but I may be pushing. I mean, actually, my cat hasn't sat down with me and said, you know, I'm over-methylated. Although he is twitchy. Maybe I have over-methylated him.
What do you give him?
Well, my secrets. My older cat, I had several cats, and they got ill, and I learned about using various things to help them with their kidneys. But I have a secret sauce that I use on the older cats, which has trimethylglycine, alpha-lipoic acid, carnitine, some extra taurine, because they really need that. And that's the main cocktail. And it did help with cats that were elderly and were dying of kidney disease. It made their quality of life better and gave them a better death and a little more time, I think, too.
What about choline?
Well, my experience with choline is that you have to be careful about how you use it. It can be tricky to use, but acetylcholine isn't so much, except that supplements of acetylcholine are usually made out of soy sludge. They make it out of soy. And acetylcholine is in, or phosphatidylcholine is in egg yolks. So I do give the older cats egg yolks, you know, egg mixed in with their meat. So for people, I think if you're eating, I mean, it depends on how severe. You said that the acetylcholine was pretty dramatic with schizophrenia, so that may be that you actually, and I would think the acetylated form is easier to use. I think just free choline can be tricky.
Choline agonists are being tested in the context of schizophrenia. Try to boost the acetylcholine levels, and they also have effects on the immune system. Choline does,
mm-hmm.
so it's complicated.
Mm-hmm.
But there are clinical tests going on that.
It would be unfair of me not to let you talk about vaccines. I find the issue extremely complex. Let me just tell you why. I'll just say a couple of things that I'm concerned about here, aside from what I said earlier about priming the immune system and letting it have a chance to develop properly in childhood. One of the problems with the research that shows that after they removed thimerosal, the mercury from
the thimerosal.
Thank you. I look at it and I've heard it, et cetera. Is that the mercury-containing vaccines actually didn't stop being used after the ban? They continue to use the old stocks of the vaccines. I've interviewed some anti-vaccine activists who point this out, that people were still getting it. But the other problem is that there are other contaminations. There are other preservatives and contaminants in vaccines. And there's also issues with live versus killed viruses. So vaccination is tricky, and I guess my main concern about it is that children have a chance to prime their immune systems on their own. And I think your argument is well taken, so I'll give you a chance to talk about it.
Well, I think in terms of autism, the postnatal vaccinations of infants, one could imagine, given our discussion, that perturbing the immune system could have bad consequences for ultimate behavior. But the many epidemiological studies that have been done have failed to produce any evidence of an association between vaccination and autism.
And is this industry funded or compared to non-industry funded?
No, there's about 15 different studies, and very few of them are industry
good.
Funded.
That's good.
One can always say, well, maybe there's a subpopulation of children who are particularly vulnerable to vaccination.
I think that's true.
But the question then becomes, well, how big is that subpopulation? Is it important subpopulation, size-wise? And at least some of the epidemiologists I've spoken with say that they could detect a very small subpopulation if there was one, and they didn't detect it. And you can see that in the history of vaccination. You can see that very small subpopulations that were adversely affected were in fact detected by epidemiology, and going back to polio and so on.
And lots of mistakes along the way where
yes.
people got sick.
Lots of mistakes, and lots of studies that uncovered those mistakes mm-hmm. by using epidemiology. The of course, everyone is aware of the other side of the coin here is if we had a significant population of people, of infants who were not vaccinated, we know that there are going to be bad consequences for that. In terms of herd immunity, and that's already been shown that with measles outbreaks, there have been deaths and severe hospitalizations and so on that mm-hmm. wouldn't have happened if they were vaccinated.
Yeah.
So we know for sure about the downside of mm-hmm. not vaccinating.
Yeah.
And
we're not sure yet about the other. I tend to think that it's. Well, I'll leave it there. I think if people want to read more about it, I think you do a very good job of discussing it. Infectious Behavior is the name of the book, Paul H. Patterson. I'm afraid I have to let you go. I'm so grateful to you for the book and for being on with me today.
Oh, it's a pleasure. It's fun talking with you.
Thank you.
Sure.
Okay. And I want to thank you all for listening. I'm Lena Berman. Visit our website, yourownhealthandfitness.org, all spelled out, for easier, extended access to our over 500 archived shows. Choose a download or a new library card feature. Also, find information about our practice, a free stream of this week's show, our book, and lots more at yourownhealthandfitness.org. If you want to reach us, you can email us at admin@yourownhealthandfitness.org. Your Own Health and Fitness is produced by Lena Berman and Dr. Jeffrey Fawcett. Remember, being informed not only protects your health, it protects your freedom.